One teen fashion magazine promises no more retouched model photos.
It's a small step, but at least it is a small step in the right direction.
Plus, marketing to the part-time vegetarian. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. There's been an online furor. A 14-year-old girl took on a major teen fashion magazine and won. Julia Blum, a student in Maine who got tired of hearing the girls in her ballet class complain about their bodies, started a petition on change.org demanding that 17 magazine feature photos of models without photoshopping them. She struck a nerve. Her effort to counteract the epidemic of negative body image among today's young women got widespread support. To her surprise, 17 agreed, and editor Anne Choquette featured a body peace treaty in her own message to the magazine's readers. Attention then turned to Teen Vogue, where teenage girls picketed in July. But a meeting with Teen Vogue's editor, Amy Astley, didn't go as well. She told the two girls who started the petition asking Teen Vogue to follow 17's lead that her magazine only features healthy models and doesn't retouch photos of non-models and real girls. Jean Kilbourne, the mother of the movement to hold advertisers and media accountable for their portrayal of women, sees the issue as a real victory for young women. Jean, you have been talking about this for a very long time, and apparently the ball has gotten rolling to the point where magazines are being asked to step forward and change the way they represent women. What do you think about the announcement by 17 that they would not retouch photos?
I applaud 17 for making that announcement, and particularly I applaud the teenager who, you know, pushed them, or the group of them who pushed them to do this. And it's very gratifying to me, as I've been doing this for, you know, 40 years, to see that at least this, it's a small step, but at least it is a small step in the right direction. So that's progress.
Are you skeptical?
Well, yes, I am. I mean, I've been around a long time. So I think that 17 was obviously getting an awful lot of publicity that was not good from this, and it would have looked very bad, I think, to have done nothing in response to the requests from these young women. So what will really be done, what will really change, we'll have to wait and see. But in terms of making a statement, I think the most powerful part of it really is that it showed that you can make a difference. It gave girls the message that if they speak up and if they act, that perhaps they can make a difference. And I think that's very powerful. Whether 17 really follows through or not, these young women got a lot of, you know, a lot of publicity, a lot of press about the issue, and a lot of attention being paid to it, and that's just terrific.
Gina, are you now looking much at the internet, as I assume that is as powerful an influence on the younger generation as television and print ever was?
Yes, I mean, I think the internet is probably more powerful, and the in general, I mean, they're certainly spending a whole lot more time, you know, interacting through social media or, you know, with their smartphones and that sort of thing than they are watching television, although they still do watch television. I don't know how much time they're spending with magazines. They're certainly spending a whole lot more time online. And I'm very concerned with that, not only because it's such an advertising medium in a way, I mean, that so much of the internet, especially the social media sites, are really becoming, they're all about marketing and being able to target people on a very individual basis. But also because there's so much pornography on the internet, and it's so inescapable, and as a result, it's become quite mainstream, and that those attitudes and those images are really taking over the mainstream culture, so that we're getting a whole lot of pornographic images and language and all of that in advertising and in the popular culture that just wasn't there before.
And what about the impact on girls of the video games and the online games, where the human body, both male and female, is so distorted and idealized. You know, you get the standard meme that we all know, the kind of chubby, overweight kid playing a game who's a big, muscular Hulk guy on his avatar. Mm-hmm. What does this do to these kids?
Well, I think it's all part of the whole way in which they're surrounded by these ideal images and made to feel that somehow they can achieve them, you know, whether it's through buying the right products or, well, mostly it's through buying the right products. But so the games become yet another way that they sort of learn this. I'm also, of course, very concerned about the violence in the games, and particularly there's a whole lot of violence. Well, there's a lot of violence in general, but there's a lot of violence against women in the games, too.
Has there been any progress made in that? Because I know when my son was playing those games maybe 10 years ago, there was great concern.
I don't think much has changed. And it's really quite distressing because there's been a huge amount of research that's been available now for quite some time that that violent images really do affect people, particularly young people. And, you know, there have been hearings before Congress, and the American Psychological Association has spoken out, and it's no longer debatable. There's just a whole lot of research that sort of proves that violent images have an effect, a damaging effect, and yet nothing's done. Nothing's ever done. And I think a lot of that has to do with the extraordinary power that these industries have politically.
All right, so Jean, 17 Magazine says it won't retouch photos to change models' bodies. What about the proliferation of shows on television now that are reality shows about fashion and modeling? Those are clearly, those models aren't retouched. Sometimes it's pretty sad how thin they are. What do you think of those in terms of what they do to the viewers?
Well, I think they do the similar kind of thing, which is that the girls in particular get the message starting so young, really practically at birth, that what's most important about them is how they look and that they need to be hot and sexy and incredibly thin and absolutely perfect looking. And then they're surrounded by images of people on the reality TV shows who are or aspire to become like this. And so they get the message not only that this is what's most important, but also that that somehow they should be able to achieve it if they, you know, buy the right products or have surgery or do whatever is possible to achieve this. So it sets up this constant cycle of dissatisfaction and with oneself, and also a sort of futile cycle of trying to achieve a look that really is basically impossible to achieve.
And does it become more difficult as the fact is Americans are getting heavier while our ideal seems to be getting thinner?
I think that that certainly is related, and it's sometimes people say, well, you know, the real problem is obesity and not so much the obsession with thinness anymore, but they're really related in a way, and they both have to do with unhealthy attitudes towards food and towards eating and towards exercise. And in some ways, the obsession with thinness sets up a kind of pattern of yo-yo dieting, which actually makes people gain weight, because dieting, 95% of all dieters not only regain whatever weight they lose, they go on to gain more. So it's like dieting is a way to get fat. And so that happens. And I think another thing that happens is people who are overweight look at the extraordinarily thin models and celebrities and think, well, I can never look like that, so what's the point? You know, so they don't, they're less motivated perhaps to become what for them would be a normal size but would never be thin enough. So it's all related. I think it's really kind of flip sides of the same coin. And there are many factors about obesity, however, of course. I mean, everything from a strong genetic factor to racism and poverty and, of course, marketing, the marketing of food and how little exercise Americans get. All of that is related to obesity, too. But it's not unrelated to the obsession with thinness and to the very thin ideal that surrounds us for girls.
Well, and aside from this 17 announcement, do you see any bright spots in the attempt to create a more healthy body image for America?
I don't see too many bright spots in America just yet, but there certainly have been in other countries. And I was at Parliament last summer in London and showed Killing Us Softly and met with a member of Parliament who'd introduced a bill to label photoshopping whenever it occurred on models, and also to have a certain body mass index below which the models could not fall. It also passed in Israel, and so I know there's been countries that are addressing this and taking it seriously. It's always harder in America to get have steps be taken, you know, to improve the public health, because it goes up against our whole kind of it's all up to individuals and it's all about individual responsibility sort of ethos. But at least there is more attention being paid to this issue than ever before. And when I started out, you know, I was really alone, and people thought I was crazy, and everything I was saying was radical. And now, those ideas are quite mainstream, and there's a whole lot of organizations and films and books and all kinds of things. So, we haven't quite reached the critical mass that we need yet, but at least there's much more attention being paid than ever before.
Jean Kilbourn is a lecturer, author, and educator, and perhaps best known for her groundbreaking documentary, Killing Us Softly: Advertising's Image of Women. Up next, a quiet but undeniable shift in a growing segment of America and how companies are trying to keep ahead of it. Plus, an intimate chat with a working woman. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1205. Former President Bill Clinton has probably done more to revise America's opinion of a meatless diet than anyone else. He's shifted the conversation away from ethics and focused on the health benefits. It's still not widespread in the U.S. It's estimated that only about 2 or 3% of Americans are vegetarians, but 10% of the population say they only eat meat rarely. And more than 40% of Americans aged 18 to 29 choose to skip meat at least once a week. That's the market the food industry is going for, with new vegetarian products that mimic the flavor and the texture of meat. Harvest Public Media's Jeremy Bernfeld has the story.
Bob Scholler is a lot like most vegetarians, except for one big difference. Sometimes he eats meat.
Thanksgiving, Christmas, maybe a birthday, something like that thrown in. Just the special meal times of the year. Other than that, we don't go out of our way to eat meat.
Scholler is part of a growing new trend the food industry is looking to tap into. They're called flexitarians, health-conscious, mostly young consumers who are cutting back on meat in their diets. Scholler lives in Parkville, Missouri, outside Kansas City, legendary barbecue country and home of the North American World Series of Barbecue. We're talking serious meat. But Scholler cut meat mostly out of his diet because he was worried about his cholesterol.
You try not to eat salad every day. You look at what you can do with pasta and what you can do with certain casseroles, what you can do with beans and nuts and mixtures of things. And sometimes you're looking to make something taste a little bit like meat. A lot of times you're not.
Yeah, I would say that a lot of our customers tell us that they're looking for some alternatives and they're looking for new ways to think instead of the standard American diet that's, you know, very animal protein focused.
Sarah Morgan is a healthy eating specialist for the Whole Foods supermarket chain.
They say that there are a lot of ways and different foods out there that kind of allow them to eat in a way that, you know, they still get maybe some of those comfort foods.
That's the new holy grail for some food companies. Vegetarian foods that replicate the carnivore's food experience so that they don't feel they're sacrificing while giving up meat. Vegetarian options like Boca Burgers and Tofurky recently started touting their flame-grilled taste and a new, juicier faux Frankfurter. And even in the heart of the meat and potatoes Midwest, food scientists are all over the trend. You hear that? That's the sound of chicken being made, at least vegetarian fake chicken. I checked out the food science lab run by Harold Huff, a research scientist, and Dr. Fu-Hung She, a professor at the University of Missouri in Columbia. The team recently developed a soy-based vegetarian product meant to mimic the taste, texture, and look of real chicken. Taste isn't an issue. Food companies have had meat flavorings down for years.
The trick is the fineness of the fiber.
The fiber, researcher Huff says, is what makes the texture just right.
The mouthfeel and appearance in a food product sometimes is just as important as the taste. If it looks bad, people do not want to eat it. Okay, if you make it look like something they've already accepted, you've got a winner.
That's what Ethan Brown is betting on. He's the president and CEO of Maryland food production company Savage River Farms. Flexitarians won't flock to rubbery meat forgeries.
I think that's probably why you're seeing people focus on replicating meat.
Humans have eaten meat for thousands of years, Brown says. There's no reason to throw that accumulated knowledge out, even if you're trying to be more of a vegetarian.
Why not create something from plants that mimics the taste, texture, and appearance of meat to allow us to continue to access all the terrific culture and recipes, et cetera, that we so come to enjoy.
Brown is having trouble settling on a name for the veggie strips. On the one hand, he wants it made clear they are fully vegan. On the other, he wants to attract meat eaters. For now, I'm splitting the difference and going with the oxymoronic veggie chicken. Standing in my kitchen, I'm about to satiate both my hunger and my curiosity. Some friends and I are going to throw the veggie chicken into some fajitas.
There we go, that's the chicken pork. That's the veggie chicken pork.
The regular chicken fajitas we made were definitely better, but once you smothered the veggie strip in some sauce, it could probably pass for real chicken pretty well. That's what the food companies are going for, giving consumers another option. Bob Scholler, our flexitarian, says he's skeptical that any vegetarian product can truly mimic the taste, feel, and look of meat. But like any good Midwesterner, he wouldn't mind if they kept trying.
You know, barbecue, you just can't find a replacement for barbecue. You can put barbecue sauce on lots of things, but you haven't replaced the barbecue. So that's a tough one. If they can come up with a good barbecue sandwich, then I think that'll sell.
Half a slab of soy ribs? Maybe one day. Jeremy Bernfeld, Harvest Public Media.
That story comes to us courtesy Harvest Public Media. Finally, Studs Terkel made a career out of talking to working Americans and sharing their stories. It's a tradition that continues and seems essential as we all continue to work our way through an economic recession. In Lewiston, Maine, Veronica McNally works at Pantheon Guitars. She's worked with wood her entire life. But this isn't your usual conversation with someone passionate about her craft. For McNally, this is just a job. A good job, but just a job.
Are you tired of paying too much for gas?
I get up 4:45 every morning and I have my cup of coffee, watch my news, get dressed after I watch my news, and then I'll take care of any dishes, sweep the floors and stuff like that.
All right, have a good day, Brandon. I love you.
Wake them up for school, and then by the time they're up and getting ready, it's time for me to go to work. I'm Veronica McNally. I work at Pantheon Guitars in Lewiston, Maine. You know, at 42, I'd like to think that I would have more than I do now. My own house. My own car. Not renting. Things like that. I smoke about a pack a day. My husband, Gerard, works second shift, and we only have one vehicle. I've walked ever since I can remember. I've always walked. I see my little hawk on St. Mary's, perches on the steeple almost every morning, and I see my little hawk, and I like that. I like nature. We're always struggling, always. He's seasonal at beans, so he gets laid off every year. So the weight of it falls on my shoulders, basically. I mean, he gets unemployment, but it's never steady. It's not steady, so that makes it tough. But you survive, you manage, just like everybody else does.
I guess we just take it one day at a time because you don't really know what the future holds. I think I just need to get out of the city. Someday.
We're outside the shop of Pantheon Guitars. I'm just getting ready to go into work. Opening my coffee, smoking a cigarette before I start. I gotta pull open the fire door. And I am the finish person. I put the finishes on the guitars. I hate scraping the bindings. I hate scraping bindings on the guitars because you got to be very detailed. You got to make sure you're not going to slip and cut into the wood. So that, and you got to hold the razor blade just right. And your hands just get tired after a while, you know, because you're squeezing that blade and just trying not to slip. This is where I spend most of my time working. It's a wooden bench. I have sanding blocks on it. I have Jolly Rancher candies on it. My chips, I'm a junk food junkie. When I was a little kid, I used to want to build birdhouses and stuff. My grandfather was a carpenter. I used to watch him, and I had a interest in it, but I don't think I ever really pursued it. And then I just got lucky.
It's time now for a BLM Lost and Found Classic.
Balance your speakers for equal output.
I am proud. I get to sign furniture for big name people, so when I worked at Mosher's. And now I'm doing guitars for high end people. When I worked in shoe shops, I hated working. I hated getting up to go to work. Oh, another day at the shoe shop. Yuck. That was long ago and far away, so. You don't hate coming to work every day. That's a big plus, you know. Which I don't. I mean, I hate working every day, but I don't hate coming to work every day. You know what I mean? So it was rough growing up, I guess. A lot of people had running water. You know, we had an outhouse. We had to go in the outhouse. And now that I'm older, I appreciate the things that I have, and I appreciate those life experiences that I went through. It just made me a stronger person, so I have no regrets. If you were born into a rich family versus a poor family, that type of thing. If you've always had, you don't know what it's like not to have. You don't realize the other end of that struggle because you've never been there. And I think there's an arrogance in that. Like I said, it's just a job. I come to work, do my job, go home, and I really don't think twice about it at the end of the day, to be honest. That sounds awful, and I don't mean it to, but that's just how I am. I appreciate my job. I appreciate my skill. But I work to live, I don't live to work type of thing, you know what I mean? I do my job, do it the best I can, and then hopefully somebody's happy with the guitar they get, but I don't really put much thought into it after.
Going to the country from the Steve Miller Band.
And now it's 3 o'clock and I'm going home and getting ready for the weekend, yay! I don't know, I just want to be happy all the time. Do I know what's going to make me happy? No, not really. I'm blue today, so. In the future, do I see anything changing? No. I try not to look ahead because I don't want to be so disappointed and let down by anything that I don't let myself have too big of dreams, I guess. Yeah, I always feel trapped. Oh, train. Train's coming, and it's not that far. Hear it? When you're in the country, it's not so busy. There's time to relax, there's time to reflect, there's time to just sit back and breathe and enjoy what's around you. Now see, isn't that beautiful? Even though they're just plain seagulls. Well, I would like to be a bird because, I don't know, you're up there, you see everything, it's just so free, you know, you're not bound down to anything. I don't know, if I won megabucks or anything, I don't know if I'd stay here and work. It's not that I don't like it. It's not that I don't appreciate it. But I don't think it's necessarily my thing either. I don't think I've ever really found my thing. And I wonder if anybody ever really does. That's my dream.
That profile comes to us courtesy of the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also find a regular column related to 51% at feminist.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.